What if the villain you've learned to hate was once just a desperate teenager trying to survive? Suzanne Collins' prequel to The Hunger Games forces us into this uncomfortable position, pulling back the curtain on President Snow's origins. The novel sold over 2.5 million copies in its first month and landed on Time's 100 must-read books of 2020. Stephen King called it impossible to put down, while universities began incorporating it into political science courses alongside Orwell's 1984. This isn't just entertainment. It's a masterclass in how poverty, ambition, and moral compromise transform ordinary people into tyrants. We're about to witness the birth of a monster, and the most disturbing part? We'll understand exactly how it happened. The capital Coriolanus knows isn't the glittering metropolis of Katniss's era, but a war-ravaged city clinging to faded grandeur. 18-year-old Coriolanus Snow lives in a once-magnificent penthouse with his cousin Tigress and grandmother, maintaining an elaborate facade of wealth while privately starving. Crystal chandeliers hang above rooms where they eat cabbage soup for the third night running. He vividly remembers war years when streets erupted in violence over scraps, and some capital citizens resorted to cannibalism. His family survived on lima beans and dandelion greens foraged from bomb craters. When he receives the lowest-ranked tribute from District 12, his terror is existential. University admission is his only path to rebuilding the Snow name, and that requires a winning tribute. The 10th Hunger Games bear little resemblance to future opulence. Tributes are caged at an abandoned zoo. The arena is merely a bombed-out amphitheater with minimal production value and disappointingly low viewership. Dr. Volumnia Gall, the head game maker, views the games as a laboratory for human suffering, conducting twisted experiments while delighting in psychological torture. Dean Casca Highbottom, the original architect, has become a morphling-dependent shell, drowning in guilt. These moments of deprivation plant the seeds of his future tyranny, teaching him that survival often means ensuring others fail. Coriolanus demonstrates remarkable political instinct when Lucy Gray Baird sings defiantly at her reaping. Breaking protocol, he orchestrates a media-friendly cage visit with food and a symbolic white rose. When confronted, he transforms potential punishment into innovation, framing his actions as audience engagement that impresses Dr. Gall while earning Dean Highbottom's calculated rebuke. His suggestions fundamentally reshape the games. Sponsor gifts creating audience investment, betting systems generating revenue, public mentorship adding dramatic narrative. Each proposal appears beneficial to the Capitol while secretly advancing his personal agenda. His moral descent follows a subtle trajectory. Initial infractions seem minor, but establish patterns for greater compromises. The pivotal moment comes when he drops his scent-marked handkerchief into a tank of deadly snakes destined to the arena, ensuring they'll avoid Lucy Gray. Each subsequent compromise becomes easier, illustrating how corruption occurs through incremental steps rather than dramatic choices. Lucy Gray isn't a typical District 12 resident, but a member of the Covey, traveling musicians who settled there after fleeing persecution. With her rainbow dress and theatrical manner, she embodies spontaneity against his capital rigidity. Their first meeting establishes this divide. He offers her a formal white rose. She plucks a petal, tastes it, and remarks it tastes like bedtime, referencing childhood baths in buttermilk and rose petals. Their alliance begins as mutual exploitation. He needs her to win to secure his future. She needs his capital knowledge to survive. Yet genuine connection develops as they share experiences of wartime hunger and loss. When Lucy Gray sings at the zoo, Coriolanus weeps, remembering his mother who died during a rebel bombing. When he nearly dies in an arena explosion, she saves him despite having opportunity to escape. What makes their relationship fascinating is the tension between genuine feeling and calculation. Even in intimate moments, Coriolanus analyzes how her affection benefits his position. When she declares they belong to each other, he thinks, that was exactly what he wanted to hear, her loyalty guaranteed. This mixture of authentic emotion and strategic thinking creates something far more complex than simple romance or manipulation. Lucy Gray and the Covey embody freedom corrupted by civilization. Their nomadic lifestyle, communal values, and artistic expression represent an alternative to both capital control and district resignation. Despite material poverty, they demonstrate wealth in sharing meager food without hesitation and finding joy in creative expression. The Hanging Tree, Lucy Gray's haunting ballad, later resurfaces as a rebel anthem during Katniss's revolution, exemplifying how Covey culture preserves dangerous ideas across generations. Collins frames her novel with philosophical quotes from Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau, Wordsworth, and Shelley, competing views on human nature that play out through character actions. Dr. Gall embodies Hobbesian philosophy, viewing humans as naturally violent creatures requiring strong authority. "We're all natural-born killers," she tells Coriolanus. "It's the conditioning that keeps us in check." Her genetic experiments and psychological warfare stem from this belief that humanity's savage nature must be controlled through fear. Sejanus Plinth represents Lockean ideals of natural rights and equality. "They're people, just like us," he insists about the tributes. His idealism makes him a foil to Coriolanus's pragmatism. When Commander Hoff bans the Hanging Tree for its seditious undertones, we see the Capitol's fear of art inspiring resistance. The mockingjays that spread the melody become symbols of how revolutionary ideas persist despite suppression. Lucy Gray's victory triggers Coriolanus's downfall. Dean Highbottom discovers his rule-breaking, smuggling food, providing poison, interfering with snake mutations, and offers a stark choice: public disgrace or enlistment as a peacekeeper in District 12. District 12 initially appears redemptive. Reunited with Lucy Gray and the Covey, their idyllic day at the lake represents an alternative future built on simplicity. Lucy Gray challenges his worldview. Is safety so valuable that you'd give up your freedom for it? This question articulates the central political tension of the series. Yet, when circumstances force a choice, his true character emerges. The accidental killing of the mayor's daughter catalyzes deeper dissent. He kills her to protect himself and Sejanus, then betrays Sejanus to Dr. Gall, providing evidence that leads to his friend's execution. The final confrontation completes his transformation. When Lucy Gray discovers his role and flees, he follows with a loaded rifle, concluding she was the only one left who could implicate him. Her orange scarf leads him into a snake nest, while mockingjays amplify her song, a disorienting chorus mirroring his moral confusion. His frantic shooting at birds and shadows symbolizes complete moral disorientation. "What choice did he have?" becomes his refrain, recasting ruthlessness as necessity. The epilogue reveals Coriolanus's calculated return to Capital society as university student and game maker intern. He inherits the Plinth fortune, a darkly ironic reward for betrayal, and poisons Dean Highbottom, fully embracing his philosophy that snow lands on top. His strategic proposals fundamentally reshape the games. Food parcels create calculated dependency. The victor's village isolates winners while incentivizing stronger tributes. The sponsor system turns survival into a popularity contest. These innovations transform straightforward brutality into the sophisticated psychological warfare of Katniss's era. Collins plants seeds throughout that flower decades later. The mockingjay appears first as a nuisance bird, Coriolanus suggests exterminating. Lucy Gray's songs, The Hanging Tree and Deep in the Meadow, reappear in the original trilogy. The lake house where they spend their final moments is likely where Katniss's father took her. Most significantly, we see the origin of Snow's rose obsession and mockingjay hatred, both connected to Lucy Gray. Here's what makes this prequel unsettling. Coriolanus didn't start as a monster. He started as a desperate teenager making small compromises that seemed reasonable. Feed your tribute, bend the rules, eliminate threats. Each step felt justified, each rationalization more sophisticated than the last. This is tyranny's uncomfortable truth. It rarely announces itself dramatically. It creeps through incremental moral compromises, through the quiet voice whispering, "What choice do I have?" until that question becomes identity. The boy who wept at Lucy Gray's songs became the man who filled arenas with children's screams through 1,000 small surrenders of conscience. Snow's journey forces us to ask, what compromises have we made? What would we sacrifice to protect what we have? The mockingjay that confused him eventually became the symbol that destroyed his regime, an echo of resistance that never died. Lucy Gray disappeared, but her songs survived to inspire revolution. In trying to control everything, Snow ensured his destruction. Power divorced from humanity collapses under its own weight.